Wendehorst in der Übersetzung von B und STB. Welcome again, back at Privacy Week 2020, and that you're all joining us here. We're already on day four, and the Privacy Week is always very enjoyable. Look at fahrplan.privacyweek.at. We had to make a couple of small changes. And it is 2020, so things happen, and we have to adjust. So the program tomorrow is likely to have some changes to it as well. So look for that in the schedule. And one further hint, if you want to give a lightning talk presentation, we're still open for submissions. So please submit that from our website. So there's again a translation, and you can hear the translation by going to the player on the streaming website and choosing the language you're interested in, either German or the English translation. And of course, you can be using the hashtags PW20 and PW20 online on Twitter, Mastodon, and other channels. And you can ask questions directly on the streaming page. There is a button, Ask a Question. And all these questions are going to be sent over to us so we can address them later in this presentation. So the alternative is you can go to privacyweek.at/fragen, F-R-A-G-E-N. We're also very happy about your support by giving us a donation or buying one of our nice merch t-shirts. And of course, all information about that is also on our page at privacyweek.at. You can also help us organize this event, becoming an angel, one of the helpers, and all the people working behind the scenes to organize these 7 days of conference around privacy. So if you are interested in helping us behind the scenes, that's always possible. So please come to the info desk, and the link for the info desk you'll find on the streaming website as well as on our homepage. All right. So now we continue. I'm very happy to hand over to Christiane Wendehorst. She is a professor for civil right, and she is a founding member of the European Law Institute. And a member of the Council of the Austrian Academy of Sciences. So a very interesting CV she has, and I'm very, very excited to hear about this topic. So it's about unfair algorithmic practices. All right, let's go. So the stumbling blocks for regulation of artificial intelligence, that's the topic. Hi, and welcome. Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here. So what I'm going to talk about tonight this is not a completed research result. This is ongoing research, and I presented that last week at a conference in Brussels, certain parts in a slightly different context, and individual elements of this idea can be found in an answer to the consultation of the European Union. But mostly this is a work in progress, and I would be very happy to get some input from you, critical input for this idea. So what is this about? My presentation has 5 parts. So the first 3 parts are questions about the GDPR for the people affected by it. So what weaknesses might the GDPR have? And finally, the idea. So how to regulate potentially unfair practices in algorithms. So this is about weaknesses the GDPR might have, but more generally, how can you regulate artificial intelligence in general? And many of the things are embedded in the current discussion inside the EU of setting up new regulatory frameworks. So the first problem I'm looking at is in the GDPR is about consent. So consent is given as the primary way, the ideal way of getting the allowance, the permission to do something with personalized data, and this is not wrong. This is very good, but the problem is, it doesn't really work that well in practice, not as well as we would like to see from a theoretical standpoint. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is more of a legal nature. Usually, so there is no physical limits to what you can consent to. So there's a formal definition. Voluntarily giving permission is kind of a material right or material property, but this consent has to be given in an unambiguous manner. And if we look at Article 4, you could consent to a use of the data that might be very dangerous. It could create massive damages for the people affected by it. And the GDPR itself has very little in terms of working against that. We can look at the fairness principle that is part of Article 5. But the question is this fairness principle, is that enough to protect against affected people consenting to use of their data that would cause a lot of damage to those people? So maybe the solution is not inside the GDPR. So there is number 42 has a very good rule that refers to a clauses directive, and this refers to the fact that general conditions, for example, have to fulfill certain standards to be legally binding, and that allows limits to be put on the consent that people can be asked for. So the problem is that there's no limit to the material, no material limit to the consent that could be given. And this potential for danger to the affected people is very high. So giving consent is not necessarily documented well. So there's various ways in which you can give consent to use of your data, but there's no need. This consent does not expire. It continues to exist. And so it's limited by the purpose of the data processing, but there is no explicit expiry date for this consent. And the rules about the information, data that can be stored, there's no, so the affected people simply click somewhere, has given consent, but there's no receipt, so to speak, for having given this consent. So it's impossible for you to track what you have consented to or when you did. So if we look at the contents of this information, so this doesn't really help that much. We have catalogs of contents. They're very long, and this is quite substantial, what's all in there. Very good. And you have to take that seriously. But if you look more closely at the catalog, you notice that one very important information is missing. The information that might be the most important for the affected people. And so for me, it's the basic question, the first question, is what are the results are affected? What risk do I accept when I consent to this? What does it actually mean for me? So personalization of website data, what does that mean? Doesn't that mean I spend save time? That I can use more efficiently? Is that something good for me? Or does that mean that, for example, all the prices are personalized because the vendor will automatically try to figure out how much I'm willing to pay and adjust the prices on the fly? And that would be kind of a trap, that I would be caught in an algorithmic price algorithm determination thing And so one of the things that should be added to this really is a view of the risks that the effects and the risks that come with the consent. So totally, in summary, we can say that the consent is the first and good reason for giving consent. And the Basic Rights Charter. But it's not the only reason. And it might be one of the most problematic reasons, because affected people can give consent to basically any use of their data. And even though there are some limitations to the regulations of general conditions. And to get this, we're waiting for the EU CJ to rule on that. And all these problems the problems that are listed, that consent is given for an undetermined amount of time. People are actually not as protected as you might think in the first. So the consent from the viewpoint of the affected people is quite problematic. So these were some of the problems with the GDPR regarding the consent situation. But there's a couple more issues with the GDPR that I can't go into all of the details for that, but there's a couple things I want to pick out, and one in particular, the problem when data is being passed on. So we have a very weird situation. We all know that data in the data economy is being passed on from one responsible institution to another. And the whole discussion about this data flow and the specific text of the GDPR so it makes you think that everything is about the first responsible instance, and so there is a relationship and a very intense discussion about data protection between the subjects and the controllers. And what that means for the relation between the additional controllers, the other responsible parties, there's very little in the GDPR about that. And there's very little discussion right now about that. So you get the feeling that there's a wall between the data protection debate and the data economy debate. And you get the impression that the data protection discussion is between the responsible parties and the subjects, but the data economy discussion is about all the other companies. And but the GDPR actually treats all the responsible parties similarly or identical. And all of them share all the responsibilities among them. And as a subject, you have rights to every single of these responsible parties. But so theoretically, you have all the same rights towards everybody in this chain of data processing. But that's only theoretical. We'll look into why this is a problem in a second. First of all, so how does this passing on of data to other parties under the GDPR is a normal process that needs a legal justification. And this legal basis can be one of many things. So, for example, you could based on Article 6, because you have no other way of doing what you need to do. Or the way data is being processed, that there is not even a reason for anybody or a right for anybody to object to that kind of processing. And it's also possible that the justification is given, but there is an option to reject the processing, or the third possibility that the only justification is that the subjects consented to the data being processed. And we get back to this very problematic justification for data processing. This opening the field to a number of dangers. So you always need a legal justification, a legal basis for passing on data. So recital 50 has this note: if the data needs to be used for other purposes than they were originally collected for, and this has to be checked. Is this the case? The only test that needs to be applied is, are they compatible? Are those two data processing goals compatible? And if so, no further consent is needed. And Article 5 talks about whether these purposes are compatible. And a couple, like scientific research. So they are certain purposes are always compatible. And if we look at the definition of scientific research, that, for example, includes all industrial research. So we see how open these regulations are. So we see that there is a very open allowance for using the data in many ways. And the recital 52 notes that the additional use of data are, so they do under are limited by the limits of the intended use of the data, but you can read this that this is the only limitation that is on this.
So if we connect all of these, that means that we don't really have high hurdles here or a lot of trouble to give on the data or give it to third parties, and yeah, they can do relatively easily do that, especially because of this combination, because the limitation of purpose can be changed, and privileges for scientific work. We have a lot of options to hand over data, and so third parties can work with the data. And these options, that the purpose can be changed, it's not as easily with the consent, but we've seen for the consent we have different problems. Yeah, so that was now the question of the legal basis, and yeah, we have already seen there are not very high obstacles, but there are other problems. So when we have a look at what the other limits are, then we see that these obstacles are not high in any place, not only the legal basis, but also in other areas. The GDPR is relatively lax. Especially in Article 28, we have very far-reaching rules, and they're well thought out. So if someone is working with the data on a contract for someone else, there are strict rules for those. However, that is not valid for people who receive data. So further responsible parties who receive data, they are not affected by this. And the European Court of Justice also cleared up that this joint responsibility is more far-reaching, but it is still limited. So if you see Article 28 in the same manner, I really have doubts about that. So we could, for example, when we're talking about when we talk about contracts to protect the affected people, and that's all in Article 28 here, that's not really mentioned in the GDPR, only between the first responsible party and the affected person. So, as mentioned, the analogy would be on not on solid feet. So we could only help ourselves with some general thoughts because of principles of Article 5 and some hints about Article 6 about appropriate safeguards. But that's a very weak protection, and it's surprising that the GDPR does not have clear rules about this. And it actually gets worse when it goes to handing over data. So what has to be documented? We have obligations to for documentation in Article 30, it explicitly says that there are categories about data. So if we don't see this too strictly, it seems to be just that Article 30 just requires a documentation of categories, but not even the identity of the receivers. I would suggest to see it more strictly, but the wording is not that does not imply that. Then another one, if an affected person wants some data to delete it, and of course it's similarly if they take back their consent, then we also have very weak wording here when they are obliged to actually delete the data and also delete it along the chain and give that request of deletion along the chain. And if there is no documentation, then this wouldn't help anyway. So similarly weak, to put it that way, is the GDPR when it comes to information requirements. So even Article 13 here, again, we can say, yeah, we could read it strictly, but if we keep to the wording, then it's basically only about recording the categories of receivers. And that might not really help the affected person. And similarly, Article 14, it's about what kind of information the recipients further down the chain have to provide, but we don't really have a clear wording, so nobody really knows what it's meant and what is meant here for people further downstream, or what kind of data they might receive in data trading and what they are obliged to provide to the affected people. So all in all, it's quite devastating what we find. So the GDPR does not address the problem of data trading, and that is a reality. Data trading is not just happening with non-person identifiable data, and basically the GDPR is not really usable for that. It's not very, there are no clear rules for third parties, there are no clear rules what has to be checked before I can hand over personal data. There are no clear rules what has to be written into the contracts with other participants in the downstream chain. There are no rules about supervision of those other people further down the chain. There are no rules about documentation, about information, and there's also nothing particularly clear about accountability if something happens down the chain that should not have happened. So all in all, it's rather weak protection, rather weak rules, and all in all, you can say theoretically it might be a lot of good ideas, but in practice, it all leads to data processing done by third parties and third responsible parties, and they're not really held accountable. And that despite all the nice rules and rights that it includes. So finally, I will shortly get to a third problem in the GDPR, and then finally to get to something that I'm working on currently. And I would actually welcome critical feedback to that. So now the third problem is what I call the equivalence of data and algorithms. The main thought is that if we have input data and combine that with an algorithm, we basically also get output data. So input data plus algorithm equals output data. Now that's a trivial thought. However, especially in context of profiling, it's a very important thing. So just imagine that we have a lot of data on Susan, and now it's possible that we have a profile for advertisement, and we have a profile of her personality for that reason, and the personality profile, we of course record that, and then we use that to use it in a certain situation to provide a certain advertisement for her. On a certain day here, because on a certain day she might have a high probability to buy red shoes, and then in the right moment it gets shown to her. But that's just one option how this could happen. It could also happen that I have a lot of data of a lot of people to begin with, of a lot of other affected people, so not just Susan. And I collected all those data and collect correlations about the connection between different criteria and their preferences. And all that gets included into algorithms. And then Susan's properties are compared to all this data. And then in the end, because of all this data, of all these other people, we have a similar result. But it could also happen quite differently. So we have a lot of data of a lot of people, and we throw all of that into one algorithm, and immediately by feeding all this data into this algorithm, from all this data that we collected without any other steps. So I don't know anything else about Susan, but immediately I get a result. And that would mean, of course, that in this middle constellation, I don't have any personally identifiable data about Susan. So there is no profile data. And there's no profile data we could demand, and we could demand to be deleted. It does not exist anymore. There is only this initial data that seems innocent. And that means that basically that the GDPR runs into empty air, because it can only affect data that is stored somewhere. But if this data might be already included inside an algorithm that uses seemingly innocuous data and extracts highly sensitive data, or rather can create a reaction that you usually would need highly sensitive data for, the GDPR does not include that case. And that means that we here have a blind spot of the GDPR. And certain algorithmic practices are not caught by that. And that brings me to my point four and the question, if we can look for a solution for unfair algorithmic practices. So what is our finding? There are serious gaps in the GDPR, especially about consent, because consent doesn't help us too much. And of course, we can improve all these weaknesses. We could improve the rules of consent or on consent. For example, we could include documentation that's machine readable. We could have automated traceability along the chain. We could order them to have an expiry date on the data. We could also demand that responsible parties have to work with all these official stations together. But we could also think it differently. We could maybe ask, there's focus on consent, and reasoning for and justification for data handling, is that maybe the wrong focus? Maybe we should focus on other things. Maybe we should focus on rational indifference. In contractual law, we managed to use that to invalidate clauses that are unfair. So users or the public people can just sign a contract, and if there would be something unfair somewhere in the fine print, then by law that's invalid. So the consumers and users, they don't really have to read the fine print. It might even be better if they don't, because the law protects them. The law itself makes such clauses invalid. And the same might be sensible in the area data protection and algorithmic protection, that we change our focus. So we don't check the consent anymore, but maybe we check if here we have a blacklist of unfair algorithmic practices. And of course, combined with general clauses that can catch new cases. And of course, that this cannot be legitimized anymore by consent. And that would mean we have a traffic light system. Green would mean it's legitimate and everything is okay. Then we have a smaller or not so small area in the middle where we really need consent and can give consent. But we also would have a big red area of prohibited data use where consent is not even possible. And that would work for data practices and algorithmic practices. And I have to say, I learned a lot. I'm an observer with the new data protection committee for this new commission, and I am against a lot of things, but this idea that you have data usages that you can't even give consent for, I think that's a very important idea. And I can find it here as well. I also think that this change of paradigm would be good for companies, because also for companies, the consent is a problem, because it's a bad reason to be allowed to use data, because it's not well defined. And it's very unclear if a court could not just invalidate the consent. And so also the companies would profit by having very clear set of rules. And one could, if we had such blacklists of unfair practices, then we could also have whitelists. And I'm pretty sure that there would be a list of practices, especially with the development of AI, where we have to say there is no potential for harm for the individual affected person. And I'm certain we could have a whitelist of legitimate data usage And with the GDPR, that would be possible. And that could really be beneficial for companies. So how do we get there? In the end effect, it's about generating general clauses, blacklists possibly. And these blacklists have to be flexible, of course. They have to be adjustable. But the same would also work for whitelists. I'm well aware that it's difficult to generate these lists. Of course, here I had a few ideas for a few candidates for unfair practices, deception, discrimination in a broader sense, in a more strict sense, exploitation of vulnerabilities, and so on and so forth. And I know that it will be difficult to formulate that, but we also can copy some things from other law areas. For example, the Audiovisual Media Services Directive. It has a lot of good ideas in it, and we could look at that. So it will not be easy to get the formulation right. However, the benefits for both individuals and data users may justify the effort. So now the summary. The approach of unfair algorithmic practices is an alternative regulatory model, both for privacy and ethical implications, and for things such as AI. And of course, it should not replace the GDPR, but supplement it. The idea is a combination of general clauses and specific blacklisted practices. And we don't want to accept those because they don't work with our European law. And of course, flexibility with this. And it has to be guaranteed that we have this flexibility if we have this combination of general clauses and blacklists. And the goal should be that individuals can navigate freely in the information society and they don't have to worry. The same as we did it in the contract law, so we can click on any number of buttons and can still trust that the law will protect us. And that could also be supplemented using whitelists, which would also help with innovation, with a more innovation-friendly climate. I think it will be challenging, but decades of experience with contract law have demonstrated that it can work and can be an effective tool. And we should continue thinking of this if we could maybe include this model in the area of data protection and make good use of it. And I want to thank you very much.
Ja, vielen Dank für diesen thank you very much for this great contribution and one of the most understandable explanations of how the GDPR works. We have a couple of questions that just came in. We have only a couple of minutes, but please send your questions through Twitter or Mastodon through PW20 or our question function on the streaming website. So I have to scroll real quick. So the question is, isn't a clause on fairness not hampered by the fact that damage is so hard to define and often damage is limited to financial damages? And yes, it's a very good question. And it's very important to not limit ourselves to financial damages. We have to look at damages in all kinds of situations. And I would go as far as say that we need to look at damages not only on an individual level, but on a societal level, because sometimes the damage is not to an individual, but the results will be felt by other people, by larger groups of people. So I would go as far as defining damage very, very broadly. And the devil is in the details. So for example, this list of unfair practices, to agree on this kind of list is likely going to be a very unthankful task. A lot of tug of war situations. I'm well aware of that, and it's not trivial to find these general clauses, but I think it's possible, and especially in the area of unfair commercial practices. That worked, even though we're in a very dynamic and complicated area, like the economy of Europe, find a way between companies and consumers to come to an agreement. And so I'm fairly confident that it's possible to find something in this very complex area as well. So I found the suggestions that you explained, discrimination, misuse of personality traits, that's a very good basis to work from. You referred to a couple of decades of legal experience and how long it could take until we have something like this. It sounds like, yes, please, let's do this. So it's hard to say how it really depends on how consensual the actors in Brussels could be. It's a lot of convincing that is necessary. But I'm very, very hopeful that this would not put forward one particular party advantage, only one party, but especially companies working in the field of artificial intelligence would benefit from the security of regulation in this field, because they could guarantee that people affected by these algorithms are actually not harmed. And so defining these whitelists and blacklists would actually help considerably in that case. And so I'm hopeful that this can lead to this. Is there a lobby for this? Well, we'll see if there's a lobby for this. I can imagine last week I presented at the European Consumer Agency last week, and they found that very interesting, and I'm just at the beginning of this, and in individual ways of formulate this, but whenever I told people about these ideas, for example, in the reply to the consultation, those were very promising. So I could imagine that not only consumer organizations, but certain companies that do really harmless research and would like to have data accessible to them, that those companies would be very interested in such a suggestion. Yeah, I think I can imagine that too. I'm very eager to find out and to see how this continues. I will put this on my watch list. Thank you again, and a big applause that we have to imagine right now. Thank you for inviting me. You're welcome. And hopefully next year again with an update. Enjoy the rest of the Privacy Week, and thank you. So for those of you in the stream, a little bit more of information. And I need to switch tabs here so I don't forget anything. So in a couple minutes, we continue. And I just close that windows. Effects of higher order. About autonomous cars. That will start at 7. And there's a couple of schedule changes. So if you go to fahrplan.privacy.at, you'll see that the things are being shifted around a little bit. So 2020 is alive and well. People have asked, what is a lightning talk? So lightning talk is a very quick presentation, just 5 minutes. And you can send us a pre-recorded 5 minute video. And we'll show those from 3 to 4 tomorrow. And then in this time slot, you can come into a workshop room at the same time and to answer questions from the audience or discuss with them. And if you'd like to do that, all of this information about the Lightning Talks is on privacyweek.at. We're still accepting submissions until about 11 tomorrow. The translators are very busy. If you like... If you'd like to support us, please, you can donate to us. We're all powered by volunteers. This is all done by volunteers in their spare time. A whole conference with talks, lightning talks, workshops, art projects, and more. So for the fifth time this year, everything in our spare time, because we're really burning for this topic. So thank you to the entire team. We'll thank you for all the supporters and all of you who have bought... bought some merch. We'll send this to you without the cat hairs. You have to attach them yourselves when you get it. We're very grateful to the support for the support of the Workers Council of Austria, and to all of you watching our stream. Did I forget anything? You can still help us out. You even get a free T-shirt for that. So go to the info desk on the streaming website. There's a link to the info desk, and friendly people will tell you how you can join the team and help out. Those were the really collected bits of information. Have a lot of fun. and the next talk. And after that, we have a Sendegarten podcast with a guest about how to podcast. Thank you also from the translators booth. This was translated by B and STB. Have a nice evening, and we'll hear you soon, or we talk to you soon.